Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, Bill Moyers on journalism as an act of bearing witness. Journalist Elizabeth Drew remembers the resignation of Richard Nixon 40 years ago this summer. Sandra Tsing Lo on being part of Generation Triple M, she calls it. Stay tuned and find out what the writer and comedian means. And what's the third language in your home state? Behind English and Spanish, a surprisingly diverse linguistic map. But we begin with a question that Richard Florida wants to ask. Why didn't Silicon Valley happen here? What kept New York, which should have been a natural for it, from becoming the birthplace of the tech sector with all the jobs and all the cool that goes with it? In his Daily News op-ed, Florida traces the roots of why the tech sector flourished in the California suburbs first and not the canyons of New York. And Richard Florida argues that tech is primed to move back to the density of cities, and in a big way. Richard Florida is director of the Martin Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto, also global research professor at NYU and senior editor at The Atlantic. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be here.
So before you talk about why New York City isn't Silicon Valley, want to talk about why Silicon Valley is Silicon Valley? Why the suburbs south of San Francisco?
Well, this struck me when I read a really great New York Times piece maybe a week or so ago about how New York had built a tech community, but it had no big thing. All of the big things, the Facebooks, the Twitters, the Intels, the Googles, the Apples, had happened in the Valley. And I, at the same time, Brian, had been looking at the rise of venture funding in New York. And it struck me, because I've studied science and technology in cities for nearly 35 years now, that, in fact, in the 1940s and 50s, New York City was the center – when I say New York City, the New York metropolitan area, mm-hmm. including Bell Labs in New Jersey, the Sarnoff Labs in Princeton, sure. was the center of what we know as high tech. And at this time, I was watching an interview with Arthur Rock, the famous venture capitalist. And he was talking about being a venture capitalist in New York but investing in the Valley. Well, early venture capitalists were here and migrated to the Valley. Many of the founders of Fairchild Semiconductors, which begat – Intel, you know, who they left Bell Labs and they moved to Silicon Valley. It struck me that the same things that led to the decline of cities generally and the move to suburbanization was behind the rise and shift of technology, New York-based, if you will, technology, out to the Valley. And what was there? A great university in Stanford and a wide open area to build something new, which we have now dubbed Silicon Valley. What was not here was the willingness on the part of major companies to think entrepreneurially. So they were stuck in this bureaucratic mindset. For all those reasons, we what might have been in New York and is now coming back migrated west to California's Silicon Valley.
But you're saying then that going to California wasn't just about escaping the city, the suburbanization that was taking place throughout white society at that time, people who could afford to. It was also that there was some kind of counterculture bent. Yes. To early Silicon Valley, as nerdy as it was, right?
And if you think about it, you know, this move of the guys who founded Fairchild, to Shockley, Bill Shockley and the group of the eight famous, now famous scientists who were at Bell Labs and moved out to the Silicon Valley, you know, that decision could have been to locate somewhere in greater New York.
But in fact, it started in greater New York, because you're talking about, for people who don't know this history, engineering geniuses – William Shockley and his folks left Bell Labs, which were really in the New Jersey suburbs.
Yeah, right outside the city.
To form Shockley Semiconductor in Mountain View, California. Just a year later, eight of his colleagues leave to form Fairchild Semiconductor. These are not household names today, but a decade later, two of those founders, Gordon Moore and Robert Noyce, along with Andy Grove, founded Intel.
And Gene Kleiner goes on, who was part of that team, goes on to found Kleiner Perkins, which is arguably the single most influential venture capitalist firm in our history. And I think, you know, they weren't counterculture people. You know, these were kind of straight-laced engineers, and Shockley was a bit of a nut, to be quite honest. But they were drawn, I think, by the ability to build something new, which they felt that, you know, already at Stanford they had spun off Bill and Dave, Hewlett and Packard, into the Hewlett Packard company. There was already this culture of starting your own thing. But what's really interesting is they were so mad at Shockley because he was such a bear of a man. when they created their own company, they wanted it to be something that the engineers could own. So in a sense, they founded a new kind of company where the engineers were co-owners. And then ultimately, Kleiner says, I want to have a vehicle to invest in this. I'm going to start a venture fund. So these guys, in a way, modeled what we now know of the major institutions or organizations, the startup company that engineers own, the venture capitalists to invest in that. They actually built that model with another guy, Arthur Rock, who happened to be from New York.
So listeners, why wasn't New York Silicon Valley in the first place? And can it be tomorrow? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Now, here's a really interesting part of your op-ed for me. You write that early tech pioneers were, quote, pushed away from the stifling bureaucratic culture of no that was the default mode of bureaucratic corporate capitalism of the Mad Men era. And when you describe the Mad Men era, well, Mad Men was Madison Avenue. That was New York.
Yep. And, you know, it's interesting. Back in the early 1980s with a guy named Martin Kenney, I actually interviewed most of these people. But I was looking at the rise of Silicon Valley. I was interviewing Arthur Rock, Gene Kleiner, all of these founding people. And I wrote a book back then called The Breakthrough Illusion. Basic Books published it in the early 90s. But I wasn't thinking about New York. And what struck me is now that New York has come back, $3 billion in venture capital funding. You know, Silicon Valley is only nailing about $4.5 billion. So New York has surpassed the city of Boston as a center. And when I was doing that research, you know, way back when, New York City had no venture capital. It was bypassed. So I was trying to make sense of how a city that lost it all of a sudden got it back. And in a way, that history that was lost is now coming back to this city. And the reason is the suburban dream is over. You know, the fact that drove people to the suburbs in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, they wanted freedom, they wanted a car, they wanted to get away from the city. Now young people and technical talent wants to come to cities like San Francisco and particularly like New York City.
And we see news stories like this all the time now. Just yesterday, I don't know if you saw it, online shopping site Etsy signed a 200,000-square-foot lease to anchor the Dumbo Heights development in Brooklyn. So that's one example. They're not going to the suburbs. They're going to Dumbo. John at the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hello, John. John, are you there?
I think a big part of the story is New York is just dominated by the liberal arts. I mean, if you think of computer science, engineering, and technology, do you think of the New School, Harper's Magazine, NYU, Columbia? No, they're all liberal arts and social sciences. I mean, they have engineering programs, but they're not that important.
Right.
Pratt Institute had the oldest computer science department on the East Coast. We had it before MIT. We closed it down.
Why?
And so I think there's a hostility to technology in New York, and the reason why it's coming back now is that design and art has become so important for the ongoing development of these technologies.
Interesting.
No, he's absolutely right. You know, the birth of modern computer science was in the New York metropolitan area, and of course at MIT. You can never say it wasn't with artificial intelligence. Stanford, you know, the dean there came from MIT, Terman, and then these engineers came from Bell Labs. This stuff was here, and I think that's what my op-ed tried to say. It was pushed away. This was the same time Joseph Schumpeter, the greatest economist of innovation, was writing about the large company stifling the innovator. So I think these technical innovators, you know, maybe if they had found Greenwich Village in an arts colony, you know, I'm making this up, but they had to find a place to nestle, and they nestled in this new place called Silicon Valley.
But I don't want to write off New York in the 60s or in general as just being Greenwich Village counterculture. Creative arts, as John says, but also finance, I mean, come on, and advertising. You would think that somewhere in that nexus of finance, advertising, and the creative arts that the new tech sector of, you know, the early Apple days and everything would have fit right in.
But these were very independent-minded people. They didn't want other people to tell them how to do their business, and they knew they were on to the real next big thing. And what they kept encountering, you know, every one of these people I interviewed, not just at Bell Labs, but at Westinghouse, I interviewed countless numbers of these people in the 80s and 90s. They said their company would invest a little seed capital. But when it came time to scale this up and build these semiconductor products, or the fellows who left Westinghouse and RCA that wanted to develop flat panel displays, the company would not invest. They had to go off on their own. So I think there was this culture of you do it in the company, you do it my way or the highway. This is not an entrepreneur. Maybe if you're an artist, Bob Dylan, Andy Warhol, go off on your own. But if you're a technology person, you're going to do it in the confines of Bell Labs or RCA or IBM. And I think that stifled these very independent-minded people who, in a way, who were not counterculture at all, who were kind of straight-laced, found their way to the center of the counterculture in this kind of ironic shift.
Jocelyn in Rockland County. Hi, Jocelyn. Hi there.
Hello.
Hi. Yes, it's you. It is you.
Yeah, this is Jocelyn
Hi.
From Rockland County.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. I thank you for having me on your show. I just wanted to say that I kind of think that the reason that it happened in California instead of New York is that New York is very, very uptight, very closed, and that if people think outside of the box, they're more likely to be censured or punished for thinking outside of the box than for not thinking outside of the box.
Compared to California?
Excuse me?
Compared to California?
Compared to California, where it's sort of wide open spaces. It's almost like that whole pioneering sense of go west, young man, go west. And you know, and then you have the freedom to start things without being clouded by the heaviness of ownership and censorship that occurs in crowded metropolitan areas.
Did you live out there at all, Jocelyn?
I've never lived out there. No, I have never.
But that's been your sense of it. And I don't know if that's too simple a stereotype.
No, I think it's pretty accurate. You know, could you imagine and going to the centers of Wall Street finance with your idea back in the day of a semiconductor or a personal computer? They would have looked at you like you were a crazy person. But this young man at the time, Arthur Rock, who was working in a Wall Street security firm, he said, no, I think I want to make those investments. He ultimately relocated to Silicon Valley. What I think is happening, though, Jocelyn, which is such – I actually think your thesis is very powerful – of the frontier, the opening of the new frontier, the pioneer, I think the United States now has exhausted the frontier. It was first the Western frontier and then Ken Jackson's brilliant crabgrass frontier. I think right now the inner city has become, in a way, a new frontier. I call it a re-urban frontier. And now you're seeing a new generation of innovators coming back to the urban core in Manhattan, in the old industrial districts of Manhattan. You know, Brian was mentioning Etsy and Dumbo, that this new frontier is actually rebuilding the urban core. And that's generating innovation. But as all of us know, that's generating all sorts of other issues about gentrification and neighborhood displacement and higher rents and unaffordability. But I really do think our frontier is now becoming what used to be seen as the place we're running away from, our cities themselves.
But fast forwarding 50 years to now, aren't big tech companies, for all their talk of how they think different, now just as bureaucratic and locked into the culture of no as the large companies that they were trying to escape in the 60s?
You're absolutely right. The best thing I've ever heard from the smartest venture capitalist is this: what this model of venture capital-fueled startup has done is that almost every new innovation requires a new company. There might be an exception like Apple, but that is the exception that proves the rule. Their notion is that once a company develops a hotshot product, it really can't devote the resources, financial or human, to building the next big thing. So what happens is, instead of getting a large company that's sustainable, you get a succession of startup companies and this dynamic and churn. So I think that's what's happened. Yes, the company gets resistant to change, and new disruptive innovation almost requires a new company or set of trailblazing companies to pioneer that innovation.
So we'll see how much this actually happens in New York. But how much do you think it's on the policymakers? And I'll ask you to look back and forward in our last minute here. Was there something New York City could have done, say at the policy level, to have fostered that early tech that Mayor Lindsay or somebody missed, you know, to have created a university center like Stanford, like Mayor Bloomberg tried to do with this Cornell thing, you know, only a few years ago? And is there something that the policy level under de Blasio needs now?
Well, first of all, Brian, this is something we're working on at NYU, and we have a great team of – and I'll come back. We have a great team of students and graduate students and researchers looking at what policies actually helped or hindered this shift today. But I think one thing they could have done is understand that innovators matter, like Jocelyn said, that it wasn't just about big companies and headquarters and giant banks. What they missed was the fact that talented people matter, whether that was a Bob Dylan, an Andy Warhol, or a Bob Noyce. And some of those people in the arts made it here. Others of them found a place, a pioneering place. The other thing – I think, is that, you know, a lot of what we did in the industrial age of policy, promoting suburbanization, building roads, you know, it leading to the deterioration of our cities, hurt this. And what helped it was the fact that people like Jane Jacobs and others maintained our great neighborhoods. Now the places that urban renewers wanted to destroy are the very same places that innovators want to be in.
And there is a question of how much we should want this, because the tech sector is now seen as largely responsible for the fact that San Francisco's middle class is largely hollowed out. The same, you know, shock of rich and poor, the kind of inequality that we have here with finance and everybody else.
The comptroller and I are working on an event in July where we've been thinking about this and meeting regularly.
Yeah, here's Scott Stringer and you.
Yeah, Scott, and here's what we think. I think. I don't want to put this on the comptroller, but here's what I think. The clustering force, the clustering of talented and dynamic people, of innovation assets, are the most important force for economic growth we have. Left unchecked, left to the market, left unabated, it divides us, it creates inequality, segregation, segmentation, and housing unaffordability. We have to build a new middle class which benefits as well. We did it in manufacturing. You know, we built a middle class around good manufacturing jobs. Now we have to raise up the bottom and build a middle class connected to this tech engine. We can't afford to disrupt that engine because it's our source of economic growth in the first place, but more and more of us have to benefit.
Well, I'm curious to talk a lot more about whether it's possible to build a real large mass middle class around tech. So why don't you come back with Scott Stringer
in
July? I'd love to continue this conversation. Richard Florida, his op-ed in the Daily News this week was about why New York didn't develop a Silicon Valley in the first place. He is the Martin Prosperity Institute director at the University of Toronto and global research professor at NYU now, as well as a senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.
Bill Moyers next. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.